Hi, Rosie.
Hey, Joel.
How are you doing?
I'm good. How are you?
I can't complain. I'm super excited to talk to you. We have a lot in common. And I'm really excited to talk to you about your community work because I think it's incredibly interesting. But I wanted to start on something else that we both have in common. One, having a lot of children and choosing to unschool them. And I'm wondering, can you tell me what unschooling is? And what it means to you when we talk about unschooling our kids?
Yeah, I mean, I guess for me, it's like, what does it mean to me rather than what it means to everyone
sure.
else? Because
there's like an official definition, right? But what does it, you know, what does it mean to you, I guess?
Yeah. I mean, it's like over the years, I've kind of, I think, detached myself a bit from the official definition, and you get different types of unschoolers these days and kind of like sub communities of them as well. So you get like unschooling, then you get radical unschoolers and things like that. But it's, you know, when we get into community and stuff, it's like, oh my God, it's a whole different world. So just to, I guess, keep a bit of sanity for myself, I just go with what works for me. And I think what works for us as a family, and what we've kind of become comfortable with over time is unschooling is just kind of living life and following the things that we want to follow and that we're interested in.
We started because we're like 20 years into, you know, home education too, and we started out and it was like very curriculum heavy, we're running a school, right? Like what people would call home school. And then over time it was like, wow, this is really hard for us and the kids. Like there's a lot of pressure in the relationships. And so like we've migrated to what would be unschooling as well, but probably not, you know, like if you looked on Google for unschooling, it's not going to line up with our house and how it works.
Yeah. I mean, exactly. And it's like, I think a lot of people think like unschooling is child led. I kind of think of it as family led these days. It's like, it's not all about the child. It's about the parents as well. It's about the family as a whole. It's like we all have needs, and we're not. It's like I don't drop everything to kind of cater for my kids and what they need. You know, I make sure they're looked after. I make sure that I kind of listen to what I think they need and what they're telling me. But you know, at the end of the day, it's like I've got needs as well. And previously I used to be torn between like my career or my kids, but now I'm just like, I have to make it work for both. Otherwise, I kind of end up going insane because, you know, I love my work. I love like, you know, the community building stuff that I do. And I think if I was to give that up, then I don't think that'd be a great thing for our family financially and otherwise. But, you know,
it's not really, and it's like setting a bad example in a way too, right? Like they need, not a bad example, but you're setting an example for your children and you're showing them balance and, you know, how to approach life in a lot of respects, I think.
Yeah, and they take it in, you know, they definitely take it in, and they you know, they see the things I do, and they see they see that I'm like the only mom who brings her laptop around with her everywhere, you know, stuff like that. And my 8-year-old listens to like the Indie Hacker podcast and stuff like that, like when we're driving around in the car, stuff like that. So it's
One of my older ones will actually edit this podcast. So he works with us so he listens to them all, but because it's a job, so they ended up in the family business as a result of the home education. It just kind of was a natural fit.
Yeah. I'm trying to do that, but I've not quite gotten there yet.
It takes a while. It's a long game. And I don't know, if, you know, return on investment, if you start breaking it down. How did you originally make that decision? Because I think that's something people are curious about. And, you know, I have my own ideas on why we did it, but I'm curious why you decided as a family with Graham, your husband, how did y'all decide to home educate?
Just the school system kind of sucks. is a general gist of it for me. Is like the more I looked into it, the more I couldn't justify sending my kids to school. We've got 5 kids. Just for reference, for everyone else that currently aged between 2 and 16. So my 2 eldest boys are 14 and 16, and they went to school for like 3 or 4 years. And like before, like sending them to like a typical like public or government school here in the UK, is like we tried a private school, a small kind of, had like 50 kids in the whole of primary, like up to the age, mm-hmm. age of 11. And, you know, we were trying to like go for something alternative that wasn't like the what the government had to offer. The class sizes were mixed and small, and it kind of like was along like what I believed would be a good solution instead of like homeschooling. But, you know, to be honest, we had a really bad experience there in our second year. And that was at that point, I just said to myself, it's like, no one's going to give a damn about my kids more than we are as a parent, as a parents. And that's what stuck with me. And, you know, I believe that to the core of my heart is like, no school, no teacher, no anyone out there will stick their head out for your kids. They won't understand. The system changes too much. Years change every year. They'll never get to know your kids like you get to know them as a parent.
Yeah, and it's not to me like there's really great teachers out there, but you're always like every year you're rolling a 20-sided die.
Yeah, yeah.
Like it's just chance, right?
And it's, you know, it's not like disrespect to the teachers or anything. It's just a system. It's just like it just doesn't sit well with me. So I've got no regrets. It doesn't mean it's easy. How we approach things have changed over time, and we've kind of gotten a bit stricter with our 8-year-old than we were with our teens. But, you know, it's still, you know, we make him do some maths and writing every day at the moment, but we've only recently done that. So it's like, you know, he's ready for it and he's not complaining too much, but it's, you know, not a lot kind of thing, but... Yeah. I don't know how long we'll stick with it, to be honest, but we'll see how it goes.
We've always liked it. You have to read, and then you know, like there's some math involved, and then beyond that, what are you into? And it doesn't really matter what you're learning to us. It just matters that you're progressing in something. It can be literally anything. What are you interested in? Let's explore that. And to me, it's been great. It's really really kind of nice and pleasant.
Exactly. In practice. I mean, I remember my eldest son. He's quite good at maths, but he did an online maths thing, and he did like the equivalent of like 2 or 3 years of maths in like 3 months. So he just like whizzed through it, and he did like 2 or 3 hours a day, just because he's like that's how his brain works.
Yeah,
he dives deep in, and then he gets bored, and he's like, "I'm not doing it anymore." But, you know, he did 3 years worth of maths in 3 months. So it's like, why would I make him keep going? It's like when he does stuff like that, it's like, what's the point?
Yeah. I was talking to Rob Walling, who founded Drip and other things, and has moved on from that. And at MicroConf, which is the conference he puts on, and there's this like weird disproportionate number of home educators at MicroConf, which is like a bootstrap entrepreneur conference. And his theory is that we tend to just think that we can do it better. And I was like, well, that's probably true on several levels. One, we think that, and then, you know, maybe we actually are able to do that as well. And that's always stuck with me. One, about the ratio, just because it's interesting if you go to those things, that there's just a huge number of home educators. But then, you know, like that idea that we just kind of, well, we can probably do this in the same way that we'll start a business or whatever to like scratch that particular professional itch, we think we can also educate and do that, and it turns out to be true.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I don't know about better. I think different, and I definitely think like my experience of like building up Ministry of Testing has influenced how I think about my kids and what I want them to do or what I want to make them do, I guess, and what's important in life as well.
So you mentioned Ministry of Testing.
Yeah.
What is that? Can you explain that to me? What is Ministry of Testing, and how did it come about?
So Ministry of Testing is a company I founded officially, like as just like an online community in 2007, but then like as a business formally in like 2011. It's a community for software testers or software testing, however you prefer to say it. And we basically, you know, geek out on testing, and we do conferences, we do online kind of talks and training, online community.
What's the relationship between software development and software testing? Like, what is the how is that symbiotic relationship work?
It's an interesting one. I think it's one that's changed for the better over the years. It's like when I first started in testing, I used to be a tester myself, which is how it kind of came about. It was very, like, testing was very much separated from development, waterfall style, I guess. These days it's much more integrated, ideally. And there's, I believe, a lot more respect for testing, but there's still a long way to go from, you know, all angles. I think testers need to do better to improve testing, and likewise for not just developers, but, you know, designers, product owners. I think there's still a huge room for improvement to just understand what testing is and how, like, testing doesn't have to be negative, and how it can be hugely supportive to the whole kind of, like, creation of a product. And, you know, it's, I still feel a bit like, you know, like we've made huge strides to make testing better, but so much work is, you know, is yet to be done, I think.
There's always, like, that healthy tension, sometimes healthy. There's always a tension between, you know, like it feels like, and maybe you're talking about this a little bit, like, between, you know, you have development and then it goes through testing and they're, you know, finding bugs. And if you don't have testing and you don't have software testers, professionals doing this, then you're putting that burden who on your users, right? Like, that's ultimately who has to test it. Or, you know, like that's, I think, a benefit of having that thing. It's almost like a privilege to work on software that has professional testers.
Yeah, I definitely think so. I think, you know, so people who, a lot of people don't get that benefit, especially, like, in smaller teams. They just can't, you know, justify the cost, understandably. You know, so, you know, me and my work in Indie Hackers, for example, mostly they're like small bootstrap companies, and they'll might never have a tester on board, and they might never experience what it means to, you know, have that feedback loop. But definitely, so if you can get good testers on board, it can like be hugely helpful. There's also the aspect of the whole, I think, generally in the industry, is that there's a kind of unfair focus on, like, automation. So everyone wants to automate stuff, but actually it's like there's a lot more to testing than just automating the testing.
I spent the last year removing robots from a lot of our systems because I had, like, built it up over the course of 6 years of Egghead and built all these cool automated robots, and then realized that's not the way necessarily all the time.
Yeah, it's frustrating. You know, it's like it's so hard to. I still don't know what the right way is to kind of to challenge that. Partly, I think, like, testers need to kind of thrive more and step up more and, you know, be proud of the work they do and be able to show the work they do. But then, you know, it's like, it's hard to show the work that you do as testers. You know, it's like developers often, like, show off, like, this bit of code, but it's like, what do testers have to show? You know, it's
like an invisible labor in some ways, right?
Yeah. So, you know, so how do we as a community, express that better to show the value? And quite often, you know, it only comes out, you know, as you say, like when the users are finding bugs, and then even then it's like the eyes go back towards the testers, are like, why didn't you find this bug?
Yeah, so either way, like if they don't find any bugs, it's like, why do we have testers?
Yeah, yeah.
If they do find bugs, it's like, why didn't you test?
Yeah.
So either way, you kind of and Ministry of Testing is kind of, it feels like part of that, part of the idea is to build this community and give more voice to these people doing this important work.
Yeah, I think that's very much at the kind of heart of it. And it's like when I started it, like, as an online community, what I wanted to achieve was just moving towards better testing and trying to find ways to create better products. Obviously, it's like, you know, the world has changed a lot in that time, and I had no clue what I was doing, but that's definitely what I had in mind.
We're all kind of just making it up as we go along. So Ministry of Testing started out, and you started conferences, and you have a local conference there in your hometown, and now it's grown to this point where there's, you know, nine 9 global conferences that happen, test bashes?
Yeah, something like that. We kind of change a bit every year. I think next year it might be 8. I can't remember.
Okay.
Sorry. I don't like get involved in the day-to-day these days.
What does it take to like run conferences globally, like personally, and I know you've kind of worked really hard to step out of the day-to-day running of that, but still, what kind of effort is it to put on a conference in a totally different part of the country than you live in?
It's hard. It's you know, people, it's like they see like the first conferences we did, and for us it was like because we had like an online presence and an online global community, and it's like we did like Brighton in the UK for the first 3-4 years, and people started saying, "Oh, I want one in my hometown, or this country." I was resisting it for a long time, and then I started saying yes. And like the first one we did outside of the UK was New York, which, you know, it was fine. We had like 160, 170 people. But the approach we took was, you know, I knew that I didn't know like the local areas. It's like if we were to like host a conference in a new location, there's lots of like logistical things that are, you know, really stressful. For me, it's stressful. Maybe for a proper event organizer, they're like, you know, that excites them. But for me, it's like a lot of unknowns about how in new event locations, new cities, new, like, where do you stay? You know, how do you choose the right location? How do you know it's a good location? Things like that.
Every aspect of it is something that you have to, like, it's a huge checklist that you have to tick all these boxes, and you are in a different time zone.
Yeah.
Many, many hours ahead of the you know, this hemisphere. It seems like it'd be, we've resisted the urge at Egghead to get into conference organizing, even though we've been asked. And I'm like, I don't know. I personally couldn't do it. It would be overwhelming.
Yeah. I mean,
I'm always impressed when somebody can pull it off.
It's great. It's amazing to bring people together, but like the logistics of it is, you know, it is hard. And the way we decided to do it is to try to partner up with local testers to help us kind of, you know, people who would know the local area, and they would help us try to find
boots on the ground.
Yeah. And that's kind of, you know, what we've done, and it's worked, you know, and you know, it's worked okay. It's like sometimes it's better than others, and you know, really, I think it'd be great to have proper event organizers who know about negotiating venues and things like that, but we don't have that luxury. And
it's kind of like when you go to hang drywall in your house, and you could do it yourself, or you could hire somebody that does it all day, every day, and both will work. But
yeah,
you know, professionals are professionals for a reason.
And it's only now that we've just hired a proper event organizer. We haven't had one until now.
I don't know. After doing this for so many years, I have to imagine you become one, but then you're like, maybe it's time to retire at the same time.
So it's like,
maybe not.
Yeah, I mean, I did it, and then I passed all my knowledge on to our current CEO, and then he did it for a while. And then we hired a community manager, and then she basically has done it for a while. But now it's like we've like, no, we need a proper events full-time person to manage everything. So hopefully we have someone new coming on board in January. So yeah, but that's, you know, it sounds silly that it's taken us that long, but it is how it is.
I've only ran a business for 6 years. I fully understand. Like, it's like stuff that looks obvious is so hard to actually get into production. The logistics of everything is complex. Life is complicated.
And actually, is like one of the like most annoying parts is like taxes for each different location that you do an event in.
Oh, I didn't even think of that.
Yeah, so like the US is quite straightforward, but like anywhere in Europe, and we've done events in Australia and New Zealand, you have to register for tax in each of the locations. And then every month or every quarter or whatever their rules are, you have to submit returns. So it's like, you know, if you do multiple events a year, then all of a sudden it's like there's this, you know, accounting burden that you have to kind of deal with. And it's not fun. It's like these are
no, that's like my least favorite aspect of running any sort of business is the compliance accounting. So I want to like switch it up because you talk about community and building community, and Ministry of Testing ultimately isn't a conference, it's a community. What are the characteristics of a strong community?
People who care. I think it's that's what it generally comes down to. It's like the people who lead it have to care. You have to show that they care, and they care about the industry as a whole, and they care about the people. And they're essentially driven by creating something better rather than, you know, the money that comes with it.
I think, I don't know if this is your observation, but I have observed this idea of, in the last several years, the idea of growth hacking and treating community maybe as a marketing gimmick. And I'm wondering, what are your thoughts on that? And is that effective in terms of actually building community?
I very much dislike the whole growth hacking approach. You know, it kind of feels fake to an extent. And it's like, you know, growth at not at all costs, but it's like focusing on the wrong things. And I came across something recently. There's a tweet, I can't even remember who said it, but it's like it really kind of resonated with me. It's like communities don't scale. It's like the work for communities doesn't scale. So everything you have to do is hands on, and it's like you can't growth hack a community, not a real community where people kind of feel like they belong. You can grow numbers, you can grow members, but I honestly believe that you just can't fake community, and that's why. Like communities like Ministry of Testing work is because I've never done any of that kind of, you know, kind of daft like growth hacking at all costs. I've never sold out on the community. In our conferences, we don't have exhibition booths or sales stands because we don't believe that adds value to the community, which costs us, you know, a lot of money. People would say that, but does it really cost us money when we don't have to spend money on advertising, and we don't have to spend our time and effort on salespeople and things like that? So, you know, as I would debate that without a problem. And actually, let's say, like, comparing it to indie hackers, it's like it's very similar. It's like everything that Cortland has built up is the same. It's like doing things that don't scale. It's like hands-on stuff to make, you know, bring value and make people feel welcome. And I very much see Ministry of Testing very similar to indie hackers, just with, you know, complete different sector. But you know, they have meetups, we have meetups as well. The only thing they don't do is conferences. Yeah, I keep trying to convince Cortland, but not yet. I mean, the vibe is very similar between the communities, which is, to be honest, you know, one of the only reasons that I considered working for Indie Hackers is that if it was any other community, I would probably say no. But I felt like
I was actually wondering that because it surprised me, honestly, when I saw you pop up as the Indie Hackers community manager. It surprised me on some levels, and then I understand it. I know Cortland; he's awesome, and what he's built is great. But what drew you to Indie Hackers as a community?
Precisely, just everything that Cortland's built up. In addition to the fact that I kept trying to hang out there, and I couldn't justify my time, so I thought, nice. Well, why don't I get paid to do it? and you know, to be honest, it's like it's been ideal. It's like, even though I've built up my business and I understand like indie hacking or bootstrapping, whatever you want to call it, it's like I felt like I was kind of losing touch a bit because my mind was so focused on Ministry of Testing and I couldn't justify the time to go and learn what others were doing. So I was trying to hang out at Indie Hackers and I didn't develop that habit But I went there a few times, and I saw Cortland was looking for some social media help, and I was like, I can do that. He was a bit confused at first when I said that, because he was like, what happened to Ministry of Testing? And I had done one of the early interviews with him. So based on that, we just had a conversation, and then he gave me a community manager job instead, which is cool.
Yeah, it makes sense. I imagine his confusion was similar to mine, but then when you see it in action, it totally makes sense. And can we rewind just a little bit and tell people what Indie Hackers is? Because I don't know that we've mentioned it too much.
Yeah, I mean, Indie Hackers is a community for indie hackers, which are founders, bootstrappers mostly, but mostly it's about people who are trying to build a business in their own way. But also, you know, Cortland's very open in the fact that he doesn't like to kind of, I guess, discriminate against people who go for a funded route as well. Sure. So, you know, they're just like a bunch of people trying to explore good ways of doing business. That's how I see it. And, you know, it started with like text-based interviews where people had to be very open about their finances. These days it's... that's still popular, and the podcast that Cortland does is really popular, and the community at the moment is just like really kind of like growing a lot. So that's, you know, for me that's quite exciting, and it's like my head's in there every day trying to help all these people and try to figure out what their needs are and how we can help them. And it's for me it's quite nice because it's like, yeah, I compare it a lot to Ministry of Testing, but it's like one of the biggest differences is that Stripe bought Indie Hackers quite early on. So Cortland doesn't, obviously he has to report back in certain ways to get like kind of budget approvals and things like that, but he doesn't have to focus on selling a product. So it's like, you know, that kind of makes it quite unique. And from my perspective, I think that's... quite, I guess, honourable of Stripe to do that. And, you know, it's from the insight that I get, it's not huge insights, but, you know, it's really nice to see how hands-off Stripe are and how much control Cortland still has at the moment to kind of do what he believes is right.
Stripe impresses me on so many levels, but Indie Hackers is probably, that and Stripe Press are like two of my things that I look at Stripe and I'm like, you don't have to do this. There's no, you know, like there's no meeting where you're sitting down, what's the ROI on this? Because there is none. And there's no like ads and there's no like direct funnel to Stripe. And Stripe is the obvious choice for a lot of people that participate in Indie Hackers, but it's not like you don't even notice it on the site. And there's no big fanfare made that this is a Stripe joint at all.
Yeah.
And it just keeps getting to focus strictly on the community and not thinking about generating revenue is such a great like service to the broader community.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, with a small team, they achieve so much with what they have. And, you know, sometimes I wish that someone would buy up like Ministry of Testing and do that. And like, you know, there's so many like testing companies out there that could do that. I was like, why won't they do that? They would get so much value if they did that with Ministry of Testing.
Yeah, and you know, like you talk about the value and the upside for the company. It's something, I don't think it's obvious necessarily, but the idea of a thriving community is such a, it's such a good thing because it has to be, there is no such thing as an engineered community. It has to kind of form around the needs of the community and the people organizing it. And, you know, like you can't fake it. You can't, it has to be authentic or it doesn't exist.
And it's, you know, it's hard to do. I say, so what, you know, the classic of say whenever a company gets bought out, the first thing you start to think of is like, oh, that company's going to go downhill. And it's hard to have control over that or know what, you know, what's going to happen. But I really wish more companies would do what Stripe have done. I think it's pretty amazing.
I think it's smart on their part. I think Stripe, you know, like it's a good investment for them, and probably doesn't affect their bottom line much at all. It's like a rounding error for them.
Exactly.
To think to thrive. And it's really amazing. So, you know, like kudos to them for making that decision. So I want to kind of close out and talk about this idea of making friends and building relationships as a business strategy. My general contractor said to me the other day, he said it was sad, but not being a total piece of shit is a competitive advantage in business today. And I think that kind of relates to what we're talking about. I'm wondering, you know, like, how do we do that? Like, how do we, you know, like build relationships and friendships and make that like serve our professional needs and help us grow ultimately as community members and advocates?
Yeah, it's an interesting one. I think the people, not so much at the top, but maybe a bit at the top, a bit in the middle, I think they should be doing a lot more to reach out to the next generation of people. And I wish more people would do that, figure out ways to help each other out and remember where they came from as well. I see a definite trend is like when people find that courage to kind of come out and participate for those, you know, for X amount of time, they really do grow as a person. And that's probably the biggest thing that I get out of like building communities is watching people grow. And that's really what drives me. I think the hard part is trying to reach out to the lurkers, the people who prefer to be quiet, but often need help. And sometimes like I spot like profiles or people that I kind of identify with. For me, it's like more kind of women and mothers who I think are often like not represented fairly in the workforce or in the business world. And sometimes I'll reach out and they'll always appreciate it and they'll always respond. And, you know, they'll slowly kind of come out and kind of like share their story. And it always not surprises me, but kind of in the most cheesy sense kind of touches my heart and when they open up to you. So it's like, I wish more people would reach out to help others. And it's hard to say when, you know, I guess people are so busy all the time, especially like as you know, they grow older, their family, business, work, whatever, it all takes over. But the real value for me is always helping people and finding ways to help people.
It's amazing. And there's a lot of opportunities. I think once you start opening your mind and your eyes to those folks and what you can do and how you can use your position and your advantages in life to help others, it's really out there. And there's really a lot of opportunity for people to do that. And it's so rewarding, like to me, to be somebody that can help people. And like you said, you called it cheesy. I don't think it is at all. I think you can, you know, like when you lift people up and you know, you get paid with really good feelings when you do that. Like it, to me, is part of the reward.
I think that's what people don't actually see is like when you think you have enough, you think that's okay. But actually these people who need you, it's like you almost need them as much as they need you. But you have to like start that conversation somehow. And I think they're much more unlikely to start that conversation because they don't have the confidence to do it. Whereas it's like, you know, if I have a bit of time, I will spend a few minutes like just reaching out to people to see if I can help or to see if I can compliment them or just even putting out like random compliments online. And it's like, it just surprises people and it gives them that first little step to, you know, help them.
Yeah. That's such a great example. I really appreciate what you do, Rosie. I appreciate what you do with Indie Hackers and Ministry of Testing. It's something that I've admired for a while. Thank you so much for taking the time out of your evening to chat with me. I really appreciate it. And I'll talk to you soon.
Thanks, Joel.